I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. A couple of years ago, my guest now, Bob Joseph, wrote a blog post that went viral that's now the basis of a new book, 21 Things You May Not Know About the Indian Act, Helping Canadians Make Reconciliation with Indigenous Peoples a Reality. It talks about the repercussions that the Indian Act has had on generations of Indigenous people. This book comes at a right time in the reconciliation process, and I'll get Mr. Joseph to tell us about his book, his work advising government and business organizations on cultural sensitivity, and where Canada is headed in the future. Bob Joseph is the founder of Corporate Training Incorporated and a member of the Gwanic Nation. Since 1994, he's provided training on Indigenous and Aboriginal relations, advising all levels of government in Canada, Fortune 500 companies, financial institutions, and Indigenous peoples. This new book is published by Indigenous Relations Press. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Bob Joseph. Mr. Joseph, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Pretty good yourself.
Excellent.
There's a lot to cover in your book. It's a small book, but it's a full one nonetheless, because there are important things that we need to talk about. And the thing that I was quite impressed by as I was reading it was the history that you provide in the book, whether it's a timeline, a chronology, or even just a discussion of the Constitution itself and the Indian Act. It's important stuff that we need to talk about and think about, especially in this time, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, I think we're in a time of rapid change. The current federal government has committed to dismantling the Act on a case-by-case basis, and so there's lots of things happening, and the book just happened to coincide with that and the Truth and Reconciliation Commission on Indian Residential Schools.
Yeah. Well, what is Bob? What does reconciliation mean to you?
It definitely is about taking a look back and understanding what it was that we were trying to accomplish, and realizing that it maybe wasn't the best path for Canada. It was ultimately designed to. The Indian Act was ultimately designed to assimilate, and residential schools was just one piece of that, where the thinking was if we could take away the children from the families and communities, that we could go a long way to this assimilation process. And so we abandoned the forced cultural assimilation model in 1982, and we patriate the Constitution, and we begin to sort of look at the history to try and figure out what to do next. And so that, for me, is what reconciliation is about, looking back, remembering the past, not living in it, but looking forward to the future where things are dramatically different than they were in the last 130 or so years.
What does the future look like? And I guess for people listening to us, I mean, there are people who are wondering what this country will look like, how it will operate. I mean, what changes does reconciliation, say, bode for Canada?
Yeah, I like it. It's a great question. You know, really, when we talk about it, it's the battle for the soul of the country. And there's a couple of perspectives. At the one end of the spectrum was this sort of melting pot idea that we throw all these cultures together into one sort of melting pot, and that would, we turn the heat up and stir it, and it would become this sort of gray, goopy mass, and that's what Canada would be.
Mm-hmm.
But when we patriate the Constitution, we actually decide to do something different. We decide that we're more of a cultural fruitcake, and that it is okay to have sort of all of these different cultures and to recognize and respect the differences. So I think that's what the future looks like. It won't be assimilation. It'll be a country that really recognizes and respects all of the different cultures and really values the diversity and the ways of thinking that those cultures can bring with them.
Now, there are people, I'm sure you know, Bob, who say that Natives should just move on. What do you say to them?
Yeah, well, that is what reconciliation is all about. We're remembering the past, but we're really looking forward to the future. We've done a lot of work on this subject already, particularly with residential schools.
Uh-huh.
The Prime Minister apologized to Aboriginal peoples in the House of Commons, being the Indian, Inuit, and Métis peoples. There's been baseline compensation paid out to the survivors of residential schools. And then the Truth and Reconciliation Commission really gives us that call to action. There's actually 94 calls to action for Canadians and every sort of walk of life, whether it's academia or the corporate sector or government to commit to reconciliation and really to get us to that, like I was saying, more of a cultural fruitcake kind of place where we really are a better country for it.
Now, the Indian Act, I guess that was conceived of in 1876, and it's been amended various times over the years. We don't, a lot of us don't realize just how powerful and how much impact that had in shaping and controlling Indigenous people. Is there a way, when you talk to people, to show or say illustrate just how constraining that was for the Indigenous?
For sure, for sure. You know, the that was part of the sort of putting together of the 21 things that originally started as a blog article.
Mm-hmm.
And in the first month, I think it struck a nerve. It had 55,000 visitors just in the first month. And then, you know, since we published, there were 190,000 plus visits to the page, 21 Things You Didn't Know About the Indian Act. And so I think there's a real appetite there now for people to learn about the Indian Act. I think it really shocked people and surprised them because, you know, when you start to look at it, it has things in it. Just in the 21 things, for example, they had to get permits to sell stuff off the reserve. And the big thing was Canada believed as long as they were selling stuff off the reserve that they weren't assimilating. And so that would, you know, somehow take away the motivation to assimilate if they were selling from the reserve. So we made them get permits, and very seldomly during the heyday of assimilation did we permit them to sell stuff. It's only been very recently that we see them able to pursue economic opportunities on reserve, and you see gas stations and hotels and shopping centers and golf courses and all kinds of stuff. But it certainly was during the heyday of assimilation, not something that we were actively encouraging. And we think about agricultural communities. We forbid them to sell stuff. And then we tell them that you're not using your lands to their highest and best use, so we're going to lease those lands out to people who will put it to the highest and best use. And so I think, you know, once they see a few of those things, that people will realize that it's not that they're lazy people and that they don't want to work. It's that this whole Indian Act system was really designed to try to force them to culturally assimilate, and it didn't work. Probably the biggest mistake, if we could look back in hindsight, was that we put them on separate lands than everybody else.
Mm.
We put them under different laws than everybody else. And anthropologists will tell you that's not the way to assimilate people. You can't make them different and then try to bring them into the same. You've got to put people together, you know, and it's like I'm always telling people in our workshops, you know, if we came together, the first thing I would take note of is the kind of food that you like. And then, you know, if you've got good food, I definitely want to share your good food. And if you've got good ideas. So assimilation is a natural process. Where when we talk about it in the context of the Indian Act, it was really a forced cultural legislative assimilation. And the Indian Act really covered from birth to death the life of Indians in Canada.
Yeah, and that's not to mention what that does to one psychologically, and just how ruinous that is to one's identity, because you really don't have an identity under the Indian Act, do you?
Not really. No, they're just trying to get you to give up the identity that you have. And you know, when we talk about residential schools, you know, my parents talk about the you know, not being able to do anything when they were dragged off to residential schools when they were kids, and how powerless they felt. And so, you know, it took me a long time to understand that that would lead to problems later in life, that they were, you know, they felt abandoned by their people and community. And then they went to these places where they were abused by the church and state. You know, it makes it understandable, I think, for people to see why they would have trouble with substance abuse, alcoholism, violence, suicide. Everything's
right.
Just higher in this segment of the population. And really deep dive it, you can see the Indian Act had a lot to do with that.
Now, the maintenance of the Indian Act today, I mean, we'll talk about the costs of that just financially in a sec, but there are people who do benefit from it. And so one wonders if you dismantle it, will a lot of people that are getting help today from the federal government, will they go unhelped, say?
Yeah, it's a good question, and people definitely have concerns. But if we look at, say, for example, the Nisga Nation, they negotiated a treaty in which they really saw the dismantling of the Indian Act. There's no more reserve land, there's no more bend government, no more of that stuff. They actually agreed to pay taxes as part of their treaty settlement package. And they agreed to pay taxes. This is the part that I think, you know, people are surprised by, and I was certainly too. But they agreed to pay taxes on the understanding that if their people were paying taxes, they would get taxpayer equity funding for taxpayer programs available to other taxpayers, like healthcare, housing, and education, and at the same level. So when we think about a K through 12 school, band schools are funded much less than, say, a regular old public school. Uh-huh. So they said, we'd be happy to pay taxes. We see that there's going to be more net benefit to the Nisga Nation if our people are paying taxes than if we aren't paying taxes. And so I think there's some really neat things that happen that way. And then as part of the treaty, they ended up with lands and resources, which they're actively looking to develop. They have, guide outfitters, and they manage lava bed parks, and they do a whole bunch of other things like that. They were even out at conferences promoting the notion that they would be happy to have a liquefied natural gas plant in their territory.
Uh-huh.
And, so what we saw was really the replacing of a system where they're really reliant on federal funding, and what some people would call a specialized welfare system, to a place where they're self-determining. Nobody in Ottawa gets to tell them who their people are. They're self-governing. They've created this really great, transparent, and accountable self-government model that includes both elected and traditional systems, and they're self-reliant. They're really going to look after themselves, and they feel that that's way better than having somebody do that for them in Ottawa. And so that's, I think, for the people that are sort of concerned about the kinds of changes, the chiefs have always said, we don't want to dismantle this thing and not have anything to go to. That's always their thing. You know, let's get rid of it. They don't want to Band-Aid it forward either. You know, there was some legislation in there recently where the government offered to repeal it, and they said, nope, just leave it the way it is. Don't use it against us anymore. But let's look at what we do next. And so I think there's some really exciting times right now. The feds have committed to Indigenous Crown relations, which I think opens up the door to revenue sharing on, you know, big projects and big infrastructure and taxpayer equity funding. So there's a whole bunch of really neat things that we can see coming out of the change. But there would be a lot of fear. And I like another part of your comment there, too, was that there might be people that really like the system. And I can see, you know, political leaders, chiefs and council, who would feel strongly because, you know, you fought hard to get elected. Now you want me to sort of work myself out of a job. I think there's perhaps some of that goes on in communities, too, you know, with man governments. And hopefully they can see the future for the nation is really in, you know, setting the stage for self-governance conversations. That's really what the buzzword to get rid of the Indian Act really is about, you know, being a self-governing community that way.
So I grew up, my high school years were in the late 90s, and so, that's when I came of age politically, following politics and the sort. I remember the hand-wringing in this province over the Nisga Treaty, you know, and the referendum subsequently to that once the Liberals came into power in 2001. Nearly 20 years now since, I mean, Nisga, I mean, is that the model for the treaty process, do you think?
I like it. It's certainly a model for the Nisga Nation. And people always ask me, is this a template? Is this a cookie cutter for all of the other communities? And in my workshops, I always tell people, it's you're a chef, but you're not a pastry chef.
Mm-hmm.
You're more like a dim sum chef. You go into any great dim sum restaurant, and there's 70 menu items that people will pick on preferences and, you know, values and that sort of stuff. And I think what Nisga does is shows us the common elements, the things that can be negotiated in the treaty and then each community will sort of pick and choose the common elements and maybe even varying degrees of the common elements to come up with something that works for them, for their culture and for their region. We consider the Nisga Nation, it's a northern remote community or set of communities, and if you were to contrast it to, say, West Bank First Nation outside of Kelowna, they're more urban, and they, you know, their outlook on treaties, they just have some issues in the treaty process, but it didn't stop them from pursuing self-government, which they had a royal assented self-government agreement in 2002, and it set the stage for them to take over the responsibilities of the Minister of Indian Affairs. And today we see over 10,000 non-First Nations people living on West Bank lands, paying taxes and lease fees to West Bank First Nations. So they have sort of a whole different outlook about the future and economic development than, say, the Nisga Nation, and it has to do, you know, mainly with proximity to an urban center versus one that's more rural. And that's why I say dim sum chef is probably a better perspective in terms of, you know, what we can expect to see.
Yeah, and to go back to an earlier point, the cost of the cost of maintaining the Indian Act is more than dismantling it, right?
Oh, totally. Yeah. If I can remember when I was, in the mid-1990s, I think it was, October 4th or 14th, 1995, the Vancouver Sun ran an article, Indian Land Claims Could Cost Taxpayers $10 billion. I thought, you know, I go out and talk about this stuff almost every day to governments and companies and groups like that. And I thought, this is going to be a tough day at the office. So I actually grabbed the Vancouver Sun, took it with me on the way out the door as I went to a workshop out in Ladner. And halfway through the day, you know, somebody in the client group said, hey, Bob, even if I thought this was the right thing to do, I'm not sure it is. There's a debt and a deficit and the economy's in a tailspin, and now we're going to have to pay you $10 billion. What do you think of that? And I said, you know, it's a great article. I acknowledged it as a great article that it talked to taxpayers about the cost of change. It would cost about $10 billion over a 20-year estimated negotiating period. And I actually went through the article with the learners. I said, if you look at it, the feds are going to transfer the cash, the province is going to transfer lands and resources over this 20-year estimated negotiating period. And I said, this is good information. I said, I'm a little bit disappointed, though, because it doesn't talk to taxpayers about the cost of not changing. And I think that would make it a much better article for people to really see the benefits of moving to self-government, dismantling the Indian Act, and setting up, you know, self-determination, self-government, and self-reliance. If we were to do that, we could stop the federal funding transfers. And in that year, I think the BC region was somewhere in the $850 million transferred to the over 206 dams through Indigenous and Northern Affairs Canada. We could get rid of the economic uncertainty. So the government of the day commissioned an economic impact assessment of land claims on BC's economy, and it determined that we lose about $1 billion a year of direct investment, plus about 1,500 jobs just in forestry and mining. We could also walk away from the treaty process. Hey, vote for me, there will be one law for everybody, and we probably spent $1.4 billion on the negotiation of treaties. And then also there's court cases that certainly have, we all know who's paying to represent the Queen's interests in any rights or titles cases that go all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada, plus the project delays and all of that other stuff. So what I told the taxpayer that day is, if money is what makes the world go round for you, if we just got rid of the federal funding transfers and got rid of the economic uncertainty, it would take 5 years to self-finance a $10 billion treaty process. But it's not really being helped along by articles that only talk about the cost of change and don't include the cost of not changing.
Right.
There's definitely some value there, I think, in terms of making the leap.
Now, you alluded to your work a moment ago in Indigenous Corporate Trading. That's the name of the company that you founded. Is that right?
Yeah.
And so you don't have to get into specifics as to the organizations that you work with, but what are some of the groups that you work with, that you speak to in the course of your work?
People can go and take a look at our testimonial page to see the width and breadth of the kind of clients that we talk to. So mm-hmm. we talk to federal and provincial governments, so all of the different agencies, especially lands and resources ones, local governments as well. I always like to just tell people it's everybody from the Ontario SPCA to the Fortune 100 companies in the country. There's pulp mills, forest companies, mining companies, oil, gas, governments, different levels of governments, you know, private sector, nonprofits, financial services, you name it. It's definitely an interesting business that way. And often, you know, I'll see something flare up in the media and I'll think, oh, there's a customer probably about 3 weeks away from a phone call here now.
Right.
Just in terms of that kind of work.
So when you go into the conference room to talk to these groups, these various groups, have you noticed a change in how they understand what needs to happen? I mean, today as opposed to, say, 20, 15 years ago?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you can see it right in the class, because initially when I get there, you know, first thing in the morning, they're asking why questions. Why should we do this? Why can't they get over it? You know, that kind of stuff, which are all great questions. And we work hard to create a safe environment for people to ask all of those questions.
Right.
I'll even say to them, look, if you're worried about how your question might sound, you can always throw a, what do you say to those people that say this in front of them? So what we do is we work through that sort of that history, that background on the Indian Act and sort of the history of Canada. And you'll hear lots of why questions, but then somewhere in the day you'll start to notice a shift in the questions. How? Okay, how do we do this? What works? What doesn't work? And so we can see that right inside the classrooms. I can remember I was training during the run-up to this year, and I had client groups, and people came in first thing in the morning and threw down the political position. There's no way we're doing these treaties, so we just work through the background and go through the business case like I just shared with you. And by the end of the day, they're like, why hasn't this been done yet? And how can we do this? How can we speed this up? And so it definitely makes a big difference. And, government people and company people, for the most part, the people that come into the workshops, they want it to change as well. They've got frustrations in their work, and I can offer them really practical solutions that don't take 7 years to put together a policy to, you know, make some change. And so definitely we see some neat things happening just right in session. And and then if you read a lot of the testimonials, they'll actually say every Canadian should know this. And so I think that's a testament as well.
Yeah, and so you are not without hope, right, Bob?
No, you know what? I'm doubling down and all in on reconciliation. My dad does a lot of work. He did a lot of work on reconciliation. He runs an outfit called Reconciliation Canada. But he was doing some peace mission work in the Middle East, and so he went out to do some peace mission work. And the communities that he was engaging with the peace mission group were, you know, they've really been at it for a couple of millennia. He said it was the most disheartening thing that he's ever seen. You know, he said it was horrible because they didn't know who he was and they didn't know what side he was on. They were, you know, spitting on him and calling him names. And so when he came back from that peace mission, he and I talked. I said, well, I like it. He said, oh, it was so saddening to see people really hate each other for so long and have really no way forward, you know, like in the short term, medium term, maybe not even in the long term. And he said, we're not doing that. We've got to create a space now for everybody's kids to really get past that. And I think that's a big part of, what we're trying to accomplish in terms of reconciliation, a good, comfortable place to live.
Indeed, indeed. Bob, it's been a pleasure speaking with you today. This book, 21 Things You May Not Know About the Indian Act, is such a useful book And not to mention informative, as I said off the top, because it's a useful book in that it gives us tools. It gives us a language that we need to have as we continue these very important conversations that are necessary in this country. So congratulations on this book and continued good luck with it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
The website for more is at ictinc.ca. The book is called 21 Things You May Not Know About the Indian Act, Helping Canadians Make Reconciliation with Indigenous Peoples a Reality. Indigenous Relations Press is its publisher. Bob Joseph, its author. Join me on the line from Port Coquitlam. I'm Joseph Plante.